B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host.
Hey, you keep it down?
Please, the Masters.
Oh, right.
And now, here's your host, a man whose high school nickname was Azalea. True story. Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, like Christmas, it's finally arrived. Masters week, my personal high holy days. I mentioned last week, my love of the Masters is superseded only by my love of family and faith, and that's about it. This week, we are all over it too. Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer attended Augusta National Golf Club Chairman Fred Ridley's inaugural press conference in that position, and we'll find out what's what in that respect. In an annual tradition, the man who got me started doing this show, Taylor Zarzer of PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM, he and I will handicap the field and we'll wrap things up with Pharrell Evans, a journalist who has written a fascinating piece on the Jackson brothers. No, not those Jacksons, the legendary caddies at Augusta National and the black caddies of Augusta. But we begin with Ron Green Jr. Ron, before we get to the Masters and Augusta National and everything involved with this week, I want to touch on a couple of things that happened last week. First off, you and I have talked before when there's been great stories about guys who went on the PGA Tour, but Hollywood would have rejected Corey Connors. The guy is qualifying to get in a San Antonio tournament on one Monday, and 6 days later, he's two-putting for par for a trophy, an exemption through 2021, the last spot in the Masters. Oh, and by the way, he got the most awesome kiss and bear hug anyone's gotten in a long time for winning a golf tournament. Corey Connors, who had a better week than him, Ron?
Yeah, I mean, changed his life in a matter of 1 week. And just to think how close he was to it never happening. I mean, I think he made a 30-footer just to get into the Monday qualifier playoff.
Yeah.
And then he advanced one at the one for six or what, 6-for-1 or whatever. And lo and behold, there's a story you talk about. There's always a possibility, but rarely happens. But he made it happen. And, I mean, next thing you know, he's on a plane to Augusta with housing taken care of, and suddenly he's in the Masters, number eight, the 87th player.
You know, it's very rare that it happens. I think I remember Davis Love the last time that Crenshaw won in 95. I think Davis Love won in Greensboro the week before to get in the Masters and then had a chance to win that Sunday. But it's very rare that we get somebody who wins that Sunday before to get in, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Davis actually won in New Orleans.
New Orleans? Okay.
But, yeah, it is very rare. It's part of what the weekend before used to be Houston, now it's San Antonio. Guys go there to play because they know if they're not in, that's their last shot. Maybe they can make it happen. It doesn't often happen, but it does occasionally. And now, Corey Connors is the king of Canada, at least the toast of Canada for a while.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest Taking Dead Aim. Another thing that happened over the weekend. And you and I have both seen you a lot more than me, but in person, I have seen Sam Snead. I have seen Gene Sarazen. I have seen Byron Nelson. And I've seen Arnold, Jack, and Gary. I've seen all of these ceremonial tee shots in person. And they're all moving when you see them. They're all inspiring when you see them. I was glued to the TV, and I don't know if I've ever seen four more meaningful tee shots at Augusta National than Lorena Ochoa, Annika Sorenstam, Sayre Pak, and Nancy Lopez to kick off that women's amateur on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, it kicked off, obviously the tournament had started before then, but I mean, that was just part of what became everything they imagined it might be, and maybe even a little more. I think it had to exceed expectations, and they have very, very, very high expectations with anything they do here at Augusta. And that was just, brilliant. And then they got the two best players in women's amateur golf going at it down the back nine. And, I was not here. We had another one of our staffers covering that, but I was at my club on Saturday afternoon, and the TVs were on, and, 50 guys are sitting in there watching those girls play, go through Amen Corner, making eagles and birdies and a finish cup head coming down there. I mean, that's just, you know, you play the last six holes, 500 par at Augusta National. That's pretty special, regardless of who you are. And it just, you know, it was just a smashing success for them, and good for them, because it's it was a big swing they took, and it just, you couldn't start off with a better start.
Yeah, it's way too early to speculate, you know, in exactness, but I was thinking as I was watching, you know, Kupcho down the stretch and what she did and Salas and just the great golf that was being played, and I thought to myself, perhaps this is the moment for junior girls golf in this country that now they've come a long way, but really kickstarts it, and girls start to really have that dream of getting to that next level, because it just seems to me, you know, the next hour you flip over the A&A Inspiration, and you know Lexi Thompson finished her round a long time ago and she was on the leaderboard, but she didn't have a chance to win, and it just seems that tour is dominated by Asian players, and for better or for worse, that does not help it in this country.
Yeah, it's a Fred Ridley, the chairman today, was talking about that, and you know, the fastest growing segment in golf these days is women's golf, and particularly young women. And it's, you know, that's something the chairman here, he's got three daughters, so it's, you know, kind of personal to him, but that's something they're going to continue to promote. They, you know, given the amateur legacy and history and how it's just a part of the fabric here, that's why they wanted to do the women's event here. And it's the kind of thing where literally you could, you know, there might be young girls who saw that and say, hey, I want to go try that. And they get involved in PGA Junior Leagues, things like that. And, you know, there's always discussion about growing the game. And this is a terrific example of how to do it. And, you know, this was just the first one.
Thank you for bringing up Fred Ridley. I find him to be extremely likable on a lot of different levels. There's something about the way he carries himself and his body language that doesn't seem, and I don't mean to be unfair to Billy Payne, but there were times where Billy Payne seemed very standoffish and had a certain, pretentiousness about him that I found off-putting at times. And I don't get that vibe from Fred Ridley at all.
Yeah, I think Fred is very sort of down to earth. I mean, Billy Payne was the great visionary and great inspirational kind of leader. I mean, look what he did years ago, getting the Olympics to Atlanta when nobody thought that was possible, and what he's done and what he did in his time here as chairman and just sort of rebuilding the club. And now it's Fred's turn, and yeah, he sets a different tone. I mean, each chairman has their own personality and has done led the club, you know, down the road to where we are now and where they're going. Fred's very relaxed. And you know, it was funny to listen to him in his chairman's press conference. Somebody asked him about how long they had floated the idea of the women's amateur and all that. And he just sort of said, you know, we don't float ideas at Augusta National. which sort of speaks to it. You know, he sort of dropped that bomb on the members, too, last year when he told us in a press conference what was going to go on. Because talking to a couple members who work on the media committee here this week, talking about the success and how they approached it and everything, and how what a stunner it was when he told us last year, and two of the members says it was a stunner to us too, because they didn't know.
Well, I find this somewhat surprising in that, you know, although they don't float ideas at Augusta National, they also don't do anything willy-nilly. There's nothing that's not had careful planning over a significant period of time to examine all angles so that the possibility of success is all but insured. That's the way that club rolls. That's how they operate. I got to think this was Billy Payne's baby for at least a couple of years, right?
No, Fred Ridley's altogether.
Really?
Yes. Now, Billy Payne found out about it shortly before they announced it. This was Fred Ridley's, I don't know if you want to call it masterstroke or whatever, but it was his inspiration, his decision, and, you know, it came off beautifully. Now he's got, you know, now the question is, what do you do from here? You know, I don't think they will change. I think it will remain one round at Augusta National. I don't think we're going to see him bring all three rounds here, although that would be great if they could. But, I mean, as he said, the Masters remains the priority, and all the planning and staging and everything is built around this week. And, you know, to think you could extend it into 2 weeks, I don't think that's what they want to do, but I think it worked out beautifully. I didn't have any idea how many people might be there watching, but, you know, as 20,000 people is the estimate, and as people who were there said, stand on the 18th hole Saturday when they were finishing, is that it felt like Saturday afternoon at the Masters, and that's what they wanted. That's what they got.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking Dead Aim. You mentioned you were at Fred Ridley's State of the Union address. I think his chairmanship is going to be very interesting, because whether he wants to deep down or not, I really think there's going to be some significant changes made to the golf course. I find it amusing the players talking about having to hit long irons into five, and really up until about 10 years ago, they always hit long irons into five.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big significant change, adding 40 yards there, building a new tee, and sort of changing the angle. Now, I think they claim it's a 313-yard carry over those bunkers on the left, which not many people are going to try. And, you know, with different conditions early in the week, guys, we're hitting middle irons, four and five irons in there. They soften that green. The big mound is still in the front there, but they added a hole location back on the left there and softened some of the rear. But, you know, they constantly do things. They rebuilt the entire 18th green during the downtime here, and now there is a pin position on the back right that, while he didn't specifically say, yes, we're going to use it, he did say, looking forward to see how that's going to play. And says, when you're standing in the fairway, it looks almost like the pin is sitting in the bunker over there on the right. So, you know, they make those kinds of changes. You know, they're continuing to monitor the 13th hole, what they want to do there. Obviously, they bought the property behind there. But, you know, Fred said they're going to be very cautious. They considered a lot of options, but they're not ready to do anything just yet. They want to see where, how, if, what might be done in terms of distance from the RNA and the USGA. But, you know, he was asked, could you just move the tee to the left to change the angle? I'm sure all of that's been considered, but, I mean, the 13th hole is arguably the best hole in golf, or was, at least. I mean, it's like a long par four now. And I do think it needs to have a little bit more of a decision when you're out of there hitting that second shot. It was not intended for guys to hit seven irons, eight irons, even nine irons in there. So we'll see where they go. That's what will be the most watched thing, but it wouldn't surprise me if they don't do anything for a while.
Yeah, there's just, you know, but what the women's amateur reminded us is, you know, the Masters and the men of the Masters, Augusta National, they get it more than anyone else, and they are able to set their course up, and they know that drama and something interesting is going to happen. It just is. And even in the women's amateur, the shot that Kupcho hit with the hybrid into 13 to 5 feet to make eagle, that's what 13 is, and that's what it should be. And there were also girls who dumped it in Rays Creek, just like everybody else has over the years. So you almost are reticent to change it because the drama is still so good on that hole.
Yeah, you know, and they played the 13th hole at 455 yards, which, you know, that's not a terribly long par five, but it fit what they were doing there. They played 15 at 480, I think, because they wanted at least to give the longer hitters the option there. And that's what it's supposed to be. You're supposed to have a decision to make. In a lot of cases now for the men, there's no decision. If you hit the good tee shot, there's no decision. It's just what club are you going to hit, not if you're going to take it on. So and I think that's what they sort of, a lot of people lament that has been largely lost. And you know, if there's a way to recapture it, I'm sure they're going to try.
Before we get to players, anything else interesting come out of the State of the Union address?
They are going to begin at the end of, very soon after the tournament, they're going to, if you've been to the Masters, you're familiar with Washington Road out front. Uh-huh. They are going to build a giant tunnel underneath Washington Road that will be used for patrons and for the global digital broadcast village they're going to create on the north side of Washington Road. You know, when they decide to create something, they're always magnificent creations. I mean, I'm standing in the media center that truly has to be seen to be believed. But so they're going to build this big tunnel. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like and all that, but it's that's the next big project, and you know, they continue to expand what they do digitally and streaming wise. I mean, now they're on their Masters platforms. They are making available this year. You can watch every player hit every shot in competition. Not technically savvy enough to figure out how I could go do that, but I'll probably try. And it's, it's funny, for a place where you used to can only see the last five holes or so on Saturday and Sunday, now you can watch everything and pick out who you want to watch.
Global Broadcast Village. This intrigues me. So I was the implication that there's going to be even more broadcast avenues from around the world, that you'll be seeing broadcast teams from other countries coming in and doing this?
I don't know any more than what he said. It's a giant media contingent that's here now, part of which I never see, but I don't know what all that means. I just know I'm sure it's going to be something really impressive.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about some of the participants at the Masters. The betting favorite, the odds-on favorite going in, is Rory McIlroy. He's on a short list. I don't know if I trust his putter. And, you know, it's one of those things, kind of like Phil Mickelson, with each year, and this would be now his fifth attempt to win the career Grand Slam, I think the internal pressure becomes even greater than the external pressure, Ron.
Well, listen to Rory talk, not just this week, but throughout the early season when he's won the Players, when he's been in contention other places. I mean, he's almost in this zen-like place right now, and he talks about attitude and practice, and he's got this thing. He was talking Tuesday about how, you know, part of his preparation now is just, you know, talking to people, juggling. Instead of hitting balls, doing some juggling, doing some some meditation. I mean, he's sort of in that. I mean, he seems like a guy who's really at peace with where he is and what he's trying to do. Yeah, I mean, he is still just 29, so he's got, barring injury or something, many, many more chances if it doesn't happen this week. And that's what he said, because this is not the end. You know, this is another opportunity. But, you know, and if he doesn't ever win it, well, he never ever won it. But, you know, if you're giving me first pick of somebody this week, I would start with him.
Is it my imagination, or is this as quiet a presence as Tiger Woods has ever had at Augusta National?
Well, given last year, you know, coming back and all that, I think it is quieter than it has been, yes. I think he is – he's still Tiger Woods. And, you know, the expectations, especially when they start, are going to be enormous. So, I you're right. It's not just all Tiger all the time. You know, he was up here, whatever – last week, Sunday or whatever, or one day, and shot 65 with a three-putt on the first hole in a practice round with some people. So, you know, he can still get it around here pretty well. I think the whole – not the whole thing, but one of the big things with Tiger is watching how he starts. He has traditionally not been a fast starter down here. He's broken 70 one time in the first round ever in the Masters. So, you know – 71, 72 is one thing, but you don't need to go out and shoot 74 and start playing from behind immediately. So, you know, I think he feels pretty good about things. I know he thinks there's some tightening up, some sharpening to do, but, I mean, I think he still belongs on the short list.
I'm intrigued always by Jordan Spieth in that, as much as I don't want to believe in him, gosh, there's something about him, and when he walks on the grounds at Augusta National, and the one bugaboo with him is driving the golf ball, and that's the one course where you can still get away with not being as straight off the tee and still be able to perform. And with his short game, there's just something I keep saying, okay, throw a couple of quid down on Jordan. I can't stop believing in him.
Yeah, I hear exactly what you're saying. I think there's, in the same way Phil Mickelson has talked about coming here and feeling different just because of the place and the history and how he's played it. I think there's a lot to Jordan about that to Jordan, and I think he desperately needs that right now. I think my guess is there's a lot of clatter in his head. You know, when you play your best, it seems to be quiet, even for those of us who play on different levels. Instead of thinking this, and this, you just sort of go out there and let it happen. And it seems like that's been hard for him. Now, I think he's got some technical issues he's coping with. I mean, his swing has changed a little bit. And I mean, we were sort of wondering about him last year, and then he came in there and was one tee shot on 18 away from possibly doing something we'd never seen done before. So I think, you know, he started well. He started well at Valero, played two good rounds, then it got away from him. I think there's been a little bit of that, too, stretching it over four rounds. I don't know. I'm hopeful that this is the week where he becomes Jordan Spieth again, but I'm probably more hopeful than optimistic.
Get you out of here on this. Give me one person that Ron Green would bet on to win and a dark horse.
Okay, since I've already talked about Rory, I've got to take somebody else. I just think Justin Rose is he plays well here. His record's good here. He doesn't make many mistakes. I mean, he's meticulous, which you need here because you have to hit it in the right spots or, more importantly, miss it in the right spots. So I really like him. And dark horse, I'll give you Louis Oosthuizen just because he's a good major championship player and played well here in the past. He's been pretty good this spring. And, God, you could just drink from the fountain of that rhythm he has, couldn't you?
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Taylor Zarzur is anchoring the coverage on Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio this weekend in Augusta. But as he was traveling there earlier in the week, we got to uphold our tradition of handicapping the field. Look, there's a list of three. It's a short list. Jack, Nick Faldo, Tiger. That's it. That's the list as far as repeat champions. So let's start our list with the defending champion, Patrick Reed. What sort of chances do you get him of joining that trifecta?
I'd be shocked if he won the tournament. His form has not been very good this year. His form was not great going into this tournament last year, but his form was better than this. The other thing I would say about Patrick Reed is he's gotten in better shape. And a lot of times, Charlie, people, when they change their bodies, for good or for worse, aren't better golfers. And Patrick looks great. Like, he's in much better condition than he was when he won the Masters last year, but I'm not sure it's had a great impact on his game yet. So he's going through a little bit of a transition there. I'd be really surprised if we saw him win the golf tournament. It's one thing to contend, but that would be totally unexpected if he was. It's one thing for Brooks Koepka, who is blessed with some of the greatest ability and just is a physical freak out there on the golf course, to go back-to-back in the U.S. Open. This would be a lot more surprising than that.
We've talked about this before. All things being equal, when firing on all cylinders, Rory McIlroy, to my eyeball, and even to some of the players I've talked to, their eyeballs, he's the best player in the world. He's the betting favorite coming in. This is, I think, attempt number five to complete the career Grand Slam. Your thoughts on McIlroy?
Well, to your point, Bill Haas was recently here in Charlotte, who's one of the best people in the world, let alone golfers. And I asked him that. I said, if everyone's playing their best, who's the best? And he didn't hesitate. He said what you just said. He said Rory is the best player out there. He should be the favorite. I know he's ranked third in the world coming into this event, but he's the best player so far in 2019. I think the problem with Rory McIlroy, Charlie, is he's too much like all of us listening. If there's one thing about Rory outside of his incredible Hall of Fame career that I think he'd like to change, is that he is too approachable, too genuine, and thinks too much about big picture stuff like you and I think about. And he has said it himself. I wish he didn't think this, but he has said, each time I don't win this tournament, and this will be the fifth year he's gone in trying to complete the career Grand Slam, the more pressure I put on myself. And I do wonder if it's between the ears with him. If there's one thing to worry about with Rory McIlroy in his game, it's making clutch putts inside 10 feet, and he's going to have to prove that to himself. before I think any of us really believe he can complete the deal. Now, his game is set up better for this event than any other event in the world. And that what's ironic is he's won every other significant event in the world. Every other major, the Players, the Tour Championship, the FedEx Cup, Ryder Cup Hero. He's done everything else but win this event. But I do worry about it being between the ears. And then history is not on his side, Charlie. The favorite, the betting favorite, never, ever wins this tournament.
Were it not for an incident in his rented home last year, Dustin Johnson may very well have won his second major at Augusta. I like his putting a little more than I like Rory's. He's a streaky putter, too, but I like his putting a little better than Rory's. Like Rory, distance is no issue. Unlike Rory, I think he's blessed being blissful between the ears from time to time. Your thoughts on DJ winning at Augusta National?
It certainly, you would think, is going to happen at some point. And I do think that this year he has every bit as good a chance as he's ever going to have to win the event. I hear what you're saying about him inside 10 feet. The faster the green, though, the more he decelerates through his putts, especially inside 10 feet. And, I know that's getting a little bit technical, but if there's any hesitation I have, it would be about, just like Rory, it would be about the putting. But his game, like Rory's, is set up to win here. I don't think he is facing the pressure that Rory is facing. Look, rinse, wash, repeat with Rory, with DJ, with Brooks Koepka. I mean, those guys are kind of in their own class in terms of physical ability. There's everything about them sets up perfectly to win this golf tournament. But handicapping their chances, Charlie, is no different than handicapping the NCAA tournament. There's just kind of some randomness, I think, in terms of who's going to win or who's going to play the best each year at Augusta National. But based on ability, all three of those guys should win green jackets in the years to come.
Taylor Zarzers with SiriusXM and PGA Tour Radio, our guest taking Dead Aim. You've already brought this guy up. The great enigma in golf to me is Brooks Koepka. He just doesn't seem motivated to do squadouche at any event but majors. But, boy, does he show up for the big ones. And in addition to being crazy long, he is a tremendous putter. Now, he didn't get to play in last year's tournament because of injury. But, gosh, Taylor, just because of the way he shows up in the big ones, he's got to be on everybody's short list.
Of course, yeah, absolutely he does. I mean, if you're trying to really be accurate about who's going to win, everybody says, oh, well, that's not very creative. Well, are you trying to be right? I mean, there's no question he would have to be on your list, too. And you're right about him being a better putter than Rory and a better putter than DJ. I think that the only question is he's never been in the thick of it at Augusta National. Nerves have never bothered the guy at the U.S. Open or at the PGA. The only thing I would wonder about with Koepka is just experience. You have to think your way around the golf course a bit more than you do in any other event. It's why I think Jordan Spieth, his record at Augusta National is so impressive, is because he has done such great homework on how to hit each shot. It's the same with Tiger Woods or Jack Nicklaus. Their knowledge of the course and their knowledge of the contours of each green is so advanced, and I would put Spieth in the same line as Jack and Tiger in terms of mental preparation coming into the event. That'd be the only thing I would wonder about with the three guys we've talked about so far, Rory, DJ, and Koepka, is do they understand the contours of the greens the way that Spieth, a Nicklaus, or a Tiger does? I'm not so sure the answer is yes to that yet.
I'm glad you brought up Jordan Spieth. We'll get to him now. He loves this place. He's got one win. He should have two. It was a horrid tee shot on 18 away last year from perhaps getting in a playoff. Watching Jordan this year, the bugaboo, his driver's all over the place. But Augusta National is the one place where you don't have to be all that accurate with the driver to contend. I don't know why I like him, having watched his game as late as just yesterday when I watched him like putt off a green. But there's something inside of me saying, go ahead and put a buck or two down on Jordan Spieth when he plays Augusta National.
Do it. I'm telling you, he's going to be in the mix. If he's healthy, he is going to be in the mix on an annual basis at that place. If you look at Jack Nicklaus's entire career and Tiger Woods's entire career, no matter what kind of form they had before or after the Masters, they almost always have been a factor there. Tiger has 11 top fives and 21 Masters appearances. In some of those cases, Tiger didn't play any golf coming into the Masters and showed up and still finished in the top five. I think Spieth is the same way. Spieth, if he could pick one golf course to play one round on, there's no question it's going to be at Augusta National. I actually was encouraged by what I saw in San Antonio from Spieth, too. Outside of the first nine he played on Saturday, the other first 45 holes of that tournament, he played extremely well. He knew he couldn't win on Sunday, so I think he started tinkering with his game in preparation for this tournament. But I think he found something in San Antonio, and I'm encouraged by his chances this week. It would be an amazing story for him to win, given that he hasn't won since 2017 at Royal Birkdale anywhere in the world. The game's better with Jordan Spieth in contention, so I would love to see that happen, and I think there's a real chance it will. It's crazy that he's outside the top 30 in the world as we get ready for this event.
Ricky Fowler has played exceptionally well at Augusta over the last 5 years, including another runner-up finish a year ago. There's not a better putter on tour. His game, based on what I saw in San Antonio last weekend, is in top form. You and I have both commented many times on this show how great for the game it would be for him to win his first major. We both futilely picked him before. How do you feel about Ricky Fowler this year?
Well, it's kind of like either betting red or black, even or odd. If you're playing roulette, just keep betting the same thing. Eventually, you'll be right. Well, that's what I'm doing with Ricky Fowler. Is eventually, we're going to get this right. But I think that after he won in Scottsdale, everything after that has been about preparation for this. Is sure, he loves to win golf tournaments, but everything has been about getting his game to peak for Augusta National. Finished second last year and played brilliant golf. It would be an extremely popular win. I think that Tiger Woods winning the event would be the only thing that would trump a Fowler victory. But even now that he's entering into his 30s, the reverberations are around the world and the way he connects to a younger generation are so good for the game. He's a great guy, but he's becoming a better golfer. I know that he still needs to win that major championship. He is you hate having this label around you, but without any, I think it's a compliment though. You can't have a discussion. He's the most accomplished player in the game right now that's still in his prime that has not won a major. And I think all of us would love to see that change. I think he's got a great chance this week, Charlie. I think his chances this week are every bit as good as last year, and he almost beat Patrick Reed.
Taylor Zarzers with SiriusXM and PGA Tour Radio, our guest taking dead aim. Get you out of here on a couple of things. We've saved these two because, look, they're the story when they show up, regardless of anything else. Tiger and Phil, more Tiger than anything else. Look, I'm an unabashed Tiger guy, and I also believe in my heart and soul that the golf gods give their great champions one last walk in the sun. I do believe that last walk for Tiger Woods will someday come at Augusta National. I just don't know if it's this year, but gosh, I sure would love to see how those guys react on Sunday with that guy on top of the leaderboard or near the top and those Tiger roars, which are unlike anything but Jack roars that you ever hear out there.
You will never hear anything like Tiger Woods winning the Masters. And with all due respect to what happened in 1986 and what happened in 1997 or what happened on any other golf course in any other year, this would be Tiger winning the Masters would be the most remembered moment in the history of the game of golf, given everything that's gone on in his life and in his career. And the fact that it's been 14 years between Masters victories, 11 years between major championship victories, what we witnessed at the Tour Championship with everyone there like they were following Bob Jones at St. Andrews was unlike anything I've ever seen. This would trump that. It would trump everything. I think he has a real chance this year, Charlie. I think that he will be in the mix. If there's anything that I worry about with him, it's this. I think he is very smart so far to pick his spots and when he plays because his body cannot hold up, and he probably played a bit too much last year. All right, so he's trying to be smart about how much he plays so his body can hold up. Because his, no matter how great a physical condition he's in, when he tells people, I need to get stronger, it's because he's gone through numerous surgeries all over his body. It's, you and me don't need to be as strong as he needs to be. He needs to be that strong in order to overcome all of those procedures. And that's what a lot of people, even his former swing coaches, fail to understand. Who I work with, by the way. I can't understand for the life of me how they can't understand. His body is so, it's a ticking time bomb. He's only going to have a few more chances at this. So he's smart about picking his spots. However, the catch-22 in this, Charlie, is he needs to have more reps, not be so rusty. So he's being smart about when he uses his body on the course, if that makes sense. But I also worry about putting 72 holes together because a little bit of the rust factor. And that's going to be what I'm worried about for Tiger if he's going to have a chance to win this event. But if he gets up there on the board, instead of making a charge like he did at Carnoustie or he did last year in St. Louis, if he is up there on the board on Friday and Saturday and he gets to play with the lead or play around the lead, I think that he's going to win the Masters. That's the key factor for him, is I think getting off to a great start, because as much as people say, oh, they're not intimidated by Tiger, they haven't seen Tiger at the top of the board. That's why they're not intimidated by Tiger. Trust me, they will be again if that happens.
You and I saw it at the Tour Championship last year. Rory McIlroy's the greatest player in the world. He was playing with Tiger in the last group on that Sunday, and by the sixth hole, he had folded Rory like a cheap suit.
Look what he did to him in Austin,
yes,
a couple weeks ago. Rory had lost one hole in the tournament before that match. It still is there, that intimidation factor. So I think that if he gets off to a great start and he's in contention going into Sunday, he has a really big chance. But it would trump everything. And as for your thoughts about Phil, I think that ship has sailed, Charlie. As much as it was great watching him win at Pebble, and how great would it be if he won the U.S. Open and completed the career Grand Slam in that same place this summer? But, I do. I think he can win a handful of more tournaments. It wouldn't surprise me, like Davis, if he wins a tournament when he's 53 or 4, out there because of his incredible ability. But Phil's focus is what concerns me most about him. Phil has so many lapses in focus out there on the golf course, and he just gets tired. And I think all of us that are in our 40s or 50s or 60s can relate to that. Is staying mentally sharp for four straight days, that's why. I think it's the biggest reason why people don't win majors once they get to a certain age. And that, to me, is Father Time is Phil's biggest competitor, especially in majors when he cares so much. I know about his putting is amazing. His record at that place is amazing. But I think one of the reasons he struggled there in recent years is because he's trying so hard to stay focused and he can't do it. I'd be really surprised, Charlie, if he was in contention or won.
All right. I always ask you for a dark horse. I've got mine, and I'm going strictly off of two things. One, he's a great putter. Two, he'd be sleeping in his own bed. My dark horse is Kevin Kisner.
Man, you stole him. Aiken, South Carolina, Palmetto Golf Club, lives within 45 minutes. He'll have so many people out there on the golf course that are pulling for him. So I really like that pick. I don't know if this counts as a dark horse because he's ranked in the top 15 in the world. Paul Casey will be on the front page of the leaderboard. So if he counts, give me Paul Casey. If I need to be more creative than that, then I'll give you I'll give you another European player that's playing in this. Well, you know what? I'll give you, instead of European player, I'll give you a guy that just qualified for this event by winning last year's Valero Texas Open. That's Andrew Landry. I think that every once in a while you see a name that you never expect to be up on the board. I'll throw a dollar on Andrew Landry if you're not allowing me to have Paul Casey.
Love that guy. One of the best and busiest voices in sports broadcasting from Sirius XM and PGA Tour Radio. That's Taylor Zarzer. And up next, a fascinating story of the Black Caddies of Augusta from the man who wrote it. Pharrell Evans takes dead aim at a time gone by at Augusta National. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Pharrell Evans has written a very interesting piece for Amtrak's In Transit magazine about the legendary Augusta National caddy Carl Jackson and the Black Caddies of Augusta. Pharrell, most golf fans, Masters fans in particular, know Carl Jackson as the caddy used by Ben Crenshaw during his playing days at the Masters, including both of his wins. But I had no idea, none, that he and his brothers had such a history with the club. In fact, your piece opens up with the story of a 13-year-old Jackson who had dropped out of school to help support his family, and he was caddying for President Eisenhower at the National. I mean, that sounds like you might as well be standing on the moon when you make that statement. But sort of describe the social and racial climate of the late 50s and early 60s in Augusta and how this was not at all unusual.
No, I mean, you know, Augusta National was this sort of very closed off world as it is now. And, you know, you had these young black kids who worked there during Augusta's short season from, you know, October to May. And President Eisenhower had been a member there the late 40s. And Carl happened to be playing in the same group. And, you know, President took a notice of Carl, and you know, the rest, they say, is history.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up that history. Carl had a couple of serendipitous moments with members at Augusta National, starting with President Eisenhower. They struck up a conversation when Carl found his ball in the middle of the woods. And from that conversation, and I guess from subsequent conversations, Eisenhower not only took an interest in Carl Jackson, but, you know, told Clifford Roberts or you know, sort of demanded of Clifford Roberts, the chairman and founder of the club, that, you know, Carl dropped out of school and he wanted Carl to get his high school diploma.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But it's sort of, you know, what that scene really underscored was that, you know, Carl didn't necessarily, you know, Carl wanted to be in school. He wanted to be like any other kid, but he needed to help his mother. Eisenhower and Clifford Roberts and Jack Stevens, who became Carl's, you know, champion and a father figure for him, they understood this. So, you know, nowadays there are a lot more programs. You know, a 13-year-old who can't work at Augusta National.
And shouldn't, right. Pharrell Evans has written a great piece on the Jackson brothers, the caddying family at Augusta National. You can read it online at AmtrakTheNational.com. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I mentioned how this was sort of a family business, the brothers Jackson. Both his brothers, Austin and Bill, caddied at the National. Those were his older brothers and in the Masters. But the younger brothers, Bud and Melvin, did they ever caddy in the tournament?
No, they did not. Bud still, he's Augusta National caddy now.
Wow.
There's a good chance that, you know, Bud is on the grounds today, and he's one of the more popular caddies there. But no, they didn't. Bud did caddy one year, 2014 or 15, the last year that Carl was supposed to work for Ben and Bud stepped in for his brother.
You did bring to light And I did not know that it was his brothers that were involved in this. But one of the most infamous Augusta National stories, and it's one of those that gets told in various ways, and sort of it's gotten misconstrued and told, you know, it was a Pinkerton thing. No, it was a security thing over the year. Was the infamous security story that happened in October of 1976. I don't even think you have the whole story because there's some people that are still keeping it tight-lipped till they go to their grave. But sort of describe what happened on that date.
Well, you know, the kids always, kids from the Sandy Hill neighborhood where Carl and Bud and a lot of the Augusta National Caddies grew up, they would cross over through Augusta Country Club, through a fence, come through by Ray's Creek. And they would, you know, they would swim in the creek. They would hang out, cook food there when it was hot enough. And the security guard saw them. Now, earlier he'd had this same security guard that had a run-in with Bud because Bud worked at the golf course. So he kind of had it in for Bud. And he saw these kids there, and he claims the gun misfired. Bud hasn't told his complete story what happened, but Bud was shot there, and there was an $11 million lawsuit, and they ended up getting very very little. Bud ended up getting like $3,000. But it's one of those episodes that Augusta National, they won't even acknowledge it. If you call Augusta National right now, that is something that's not a part of the history of the club.
Yeah, it is. It is shrouded in mystery and secrecy, and that's why I was wondering if you had gotten the straight scoop from Bud.
Yeah, well, Bud, where I got most of my stuff was from the sworn testimony that was in the court documents back when this happened, that kind of came out during the settlement, the whole settlement phase. That security guard continued to work at the club. Bud took a 11-year hiatus from the club. Didn't work there until like 1987 or so, after working for the Augusta school system. But it's just one of those things that people didn't talk about, wouldn't bring up, but certainly something that is a part of the Jackson family and their history with the club.
The Jackson family, the brothers, the caddies at Augusta National, the subject of a brilliant piece by Pharrell Evans. I want you to check it out, AmtrakTheNational.com. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Back to Carl for a second. At 14... he caddied in his first Masters. Let me say that out loud again, because that sounds insane. At 14, he caddied in his first Masters. You can't imagine any tour pro, even if it was their son, doing that today. But Augusta, up until the 80s, had a bizarre requirement when it came to the Masters, and that was you had to use their caddies. Now, this was a Clifford Roberts thing. What was his point?
Well, it was his rule. Now, Bud and Carl will tell you this. Anybody who's been to Augusta or knows anything or read anything about Augusta National, it is the most private place in the world. What happens at Augusta National stays at Augusta National. The business of the members, it is a business of the members. Bud told me, you know, one of the things that Clifford was strong about, if you start having outside caddies, they're going to start getting into the business of the members.
Mm.
And Clifford Roberts ran Augusta like, you know, Bobby Jones, he and Bobby Jones built the club together, but Clifford ran the club.
Yes.
And he wanted homegrown people. He wanted... From the inception, there were black caddies, black maids, black waiters. The majority of the work, the staff at the club were African Americans, and that was the structure: white members, black help, And so, you know, call it bizarre or not, these were, and as I pointed out in the piece, is that this was a, these were good jobs. These were good jobs. And if you were a caddy or you worked in the help staff during the Masters week, that's the most money you made all week with tips.
Right.
And if you got the purse. So, you know, it was the next best thing to having a union job in a place where there were few opportunities if you were poor and black.
Pharrell, Clifford Roberts' background was in the financial industry, and he was from New York State, specifically New York City. Does it surprise you that someone from that background would be so insistent upon the segregation that he was, that blacks will do this and whites will do this?
Well, I mean, you know, all those guys, they came down to play golf in the, you know, during the winter, and you know, it didn't matter where you're from. You came down south. You fell into the mores of what things were like down south, and so I don't know Clifford's his personal beliefs, but I do know that during the Brown versus Board of Education, when Eisenhower had to send troops into Little Rock to enforce that, Clifford Roberts said in his book that, you know, he thought it was important what President Eisenhower did, which was enforce the law, enforce what the court said. So, you know, was he paternalistic and old school? But people who knew Clifford Roberts, like Carl Jackson and Bud Jackson, they would tell you that Clifford Roberts was not a racist. He was a hard, old-line man who liked things a certain way. Would he have evolved in 2019 to where a more diverse workforce? He didn't insist on black workers and white members. Perhaps, but we'll never know.
Pharrell Evans has written The Black Caddies of Augusta National, The Untold Story of the Jackson Brothers. It's a brilliant piece at AmtrakTheNational.com. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Besides Eisenhower, and you mentioned it briefly a few minutes ago, Carl Jackson had another life-changing relationship at Augusta National, and that was with Jack Stevens from the state of Arkansas. I say from the state of Arkansas because outside of Sam, I always thought that Sam Walton owned half of Arkansas and Jack Stevens owned the other half of Arkansas. I was completely oblivious as to the depth of their relationship.
Oh gosh. I mean the single most important male relationship for Carl Jackson, other than his grandfather, was Jack Stevens. And the Stevens family, you know, Carl worked and lived with Jack Stevens for 17 or 18 years. Flew back and forth on Mr. Stevens' private plane between Little Rock and Augusta. You know, he did everything for him, handled his real estate. And today, you know, as the piece points out, Carl is the caddy master at the Aloysian Club, right, outside of Little Rock, where Jack Stevens' his son Warren, of course, that Warren built, which is patterned after Augusta National. So, you know, that relationship, which all started in 1960 and 61, the first time that Carl caddied for Jack Stevens was in 61 when he was in the group with Eisenhower, and they had that conversation about his education. And we're talking about 50-plus years later, that relationship, the single most important professional relationship that Carl Jackson has had in his life. Imagine being a 14-year-old kid, and you meet one of the most powerful people in American finance, and he takes you under his wing. And Carl is 72 years old, and he's still connected to that family.
And if I was completely unaware as to the depth of the relationship, I was totally oblivious to what happened with Carl and Mr. Stevens in 1978 on the grounds. To say that this was groundbreaking, it probably shook the earth based on that time period at Augusta National. What happened?
Well, Mr. Stevens' attitude was, and it kind of just happened. It was one day Mr. Stevens told the club pros, you know, we're going to have a match, me and Carl against these couple of club pros who worked at the club, and he told the caddy master. He said, go get Carl a brand new set of clothes and some shoes and get him outfitted so he'll look real good when we get on the golf course. So as soon as all of this is taking place, people start calling Bill Lane, who was the chairman of Augusta National, like, you know, Jack Stevens is about to take Carl out to play, you know, and this is about to happen. So everybody's the secretaries, everybody's kind of up in arms. They don't, you know, about to take a caddy out on the golf course and play. When caddies only got to play once a year at Augusta National, which is still the same way it is now.
Right.
And so, you know, Jack Stevens said, you know, I don't care. We're doing it. So they go out and, you know, Carl beat everybody. And they had a great day, and the staff came out when he was on the first tee and teeing off, and he hit a good little drive down the middle there, and everybody was excited for him. And so Carl is very much an icon at Augusta, a place where they don't really make icons around it. They don't do anniversaries. They don't give trophies and honors. You know, Carl doesn't have a special place when he goes to the Masters every year. He gets a badge like everybody else, and he walks around. And if Ben Crenshaw plays in the par three on Wednesday, Carl will probably caddy for him. But they don't make heroes there unless you make a hero on the golf course, and even then you fade from memory very soon there, because that's just the way the place is.
Pharrell Evans is the author of a great piece at AmtrakTheNational.com, The Black Caddies of Augusta National, The Untold Story of the Jackson Brothers. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. I remember the litany of colorful names and personalities that were the caddies at the National. It seems like once 1983 happened and they were no longer caddying at the tournament, that cottage industry just sort of disappeared. What happened?
Well, for years and years, you know, some top players from Tom Watson, Jack Nicklaus, those guys have been saying, we want to bring our own caddies that we work with week to week on the PGA Tour. They know us. They know everything about us. We have to come here to Augusta, and we have to work with the caddies that we don't know. So, you know, Augusta doesn't change traditions often. So after Clifford Roberts died in 1977 of an apparent suicide, it made a little bit easier to try to pass that thing through. So during the 82 Masters, they had a rain delay, and during the rain delay, the caddies and players came off the golf course, and they sent the caddies home, and the bags got wet. You know, so yeah. You had like all of these bags wet, and that sort of like really upset the players, and there was this really big outcry. Like, we gotta do something, and that allowed it from so 83 on. You had it opened up, and so, you know, since 83, gradually, you've seen the disappearance of black caddies. Used to be 100%. So anybody who played in that event from 1935 on to 1935, every winter,
you had a black caddy from Augusta, Georgia, who worked at Augusta National. Since 1983, 1984, it's been gradually the disappearance of black caddies. And then also the place of the residents, the native Augustans, as a part of the tournament. So last year you had one black caddy who was from South Africa who caddied for Brandon Grace. You know, it's unlikely if there will be one this week. Now, for many people in this generation, okay, that's progress, people say. But if you're from Augusta and you were a part of that tradition and that was a big week for you financially as it was, it's a big loss. And so, Carl was the last, kind of the last one who had been a presence, that continuum, that legacy that was created by Clifford Roberts and Bobby Jones. So tradition, you know, a tradition like no other, they call, you know, the Masters. And that's one tradition that is lost.
I really can't commend that piece highly enough. That's Pharrell Evans. I'd also like to thank my friends Taylor Zarzer of SiriusXM and PGA Tour Radio and Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for their time and insight this week. A reminder, a great way to stay in the loop with us is to be a regular consumer of our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Also, our terrestrial radio times have changed on Fox Sports Radio Charlotte, 94.7 FM and 1660 AM. You can now hear us twice a weekend, Saturday mornings from 7 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to noon. Weather-wise, well, you knew it had to end, right? For the most part, a washout is predicted. But if you do find a way to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.